Welcome to episode 18 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, and now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. And we're really delighted to have with us as a guest commentator Brian Krebs, who's the founder and author of Krebs on Security, one of the go-to sites for breaking news on security issues. From 1995 to 2009, Brian was a reporter for the Washington Post, and then he decided to go out on his own and launch his own site. I guess it's fair to say it's working out now, isn't it, Brian?
It's probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
They get rid of my job at the Post. You know, you don't know what else to do as a journalist to keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah. No, I tell that to journalists all the time. You can keep trying to make this work, but you're really better off finding something else. You're too talented to go down with the ship.
I constantly try to corrupt my colleagues at every turn.
Yeah. All right. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA and DHS, and now in the Washington office of Steptoe & Johnson. Let's get started. We traditionally start out with This Week in NSA, but frankly, I'm not sure how long that feature is for the podcast. There was almost no interesting news about NSA. Glenn Greenwald's outlet, The Intercept, came up with a story that probably is their worst yet in terms of trying to make a mountain out of a molehill. The headline of the story was that NSA was somehow GCHQ, the British version of NSA, was somehow secretly begging to get access to NSA data. Of course, they have access to a lot of data. What this really was a protocol memo of the sort written for the director whenever somebody visits from abroad that says, here are the issues that you should watch out for. And in the course of predicting things that might come up, it says, by the way, they're still interested in getting more access to certain kinds of PRISM-related data. The implication was that NSA, for privacy reasons, was slow-rolling or denying that request. Glenn Greenwald had the opportunity to say, look at NSA protecting the privacy of Americans, but the likelihood that he would take that tack was zero. So instead, he tried to spin it that GCHQ was asking for things it shouldn't ask for, although there's no real evidence of that and no evidence that they got access of the sort that they were asking for. So I'm not sure what the story is. Even after reading the story two or three times, I'm not sure what the story is. So it's clearly the winning candidate for dumbest NSA story of the month, at least so far. The other issues in this area, also GCHQ, turns out that GCHQ has a monitor of its own who oversees the activities of GCHQ and then writes a public report about it. The Interception of Communications Commissioner wrote a very long report that's now on the web about activities of GCHQ and answering questions of people who'd written to him saying, is GCHQ trawling through all of British communications and looking at everybody's communications? And he more or less, actually, it was a pretty sweeping vindication of the agency from the investigator. He had clearances to look at a variety of things, and he makes some pretty sweeping statements about abuses that he thinks are not occurring at GCHQ. So GCHQ should be pretty pleased with that. Surprisingly, The Intercept did not cover it. And finally, Angela Merkel came to town against a backdrop where the U.S. and Germany have had strained relations over reports that Angela Merkel's cell phone was being targeted by NSA. The president has told her that has ended, but the German government has been asking for a very broad no-spy agreement, essentially an agreement that nothing that's done by U.S. intelligence on German soil will be contrary to German law, which would mean that there won't be any intelligence gathered on German soil. That's not an agreement that the U.S. has with anyone, and certainly not with anyone who produces as little useful intelligence as the German government. So it's not a surprise that the talks collapsed. I think the German government felt mousetrapped by domestic politics, that they had to ask for that, and that if they didn't get that, they wouldn't have an agreement that they could brag about to the German public. So it was almost easier for the U.S. to say no and to accept a no than to try to reach agreement on something a little more realistic. So that is this week in NSA. Not that much happening. There will be a debate, I think, in the next 24 hours between Glenn Greenwald and former director Hayden over some of these leak issues that might be interesting to cover next week. Probably the bigger news, and I think it's gotten some coverage, but maybe not enough, is a magistrate in the Southern District of New York ruled that the government can serve a warrant on Microsoft, asking Microsoft to produce emails that are not stored in the United States, but which are stored in Ireland. And Microsoft said, excuse me, but this is a warrant, and search warrants can't be written for actions outside the United States. There's no Fourth Amendment protection outside the United States, and it's generally been believed that there isn't any jurisdiction to either carry out or authorize searches outside the United States. And the magistrate said, well, boy, if that's the case, we're going to have a big problem investigating cases, and ruled that this particular warrant could be served as though it were a subpoena on Microsoft to produce data from outside the U.S. Michael, I know you looked at that pretty closely. What do you think is going to happen next, and how serious an issue is this?
It's a really big issue. I think the next step is Microsoft is going to appeal. It's not really an appeal, but they're going to try to revisit the issue with an Article 3 district court judge, arguing that the magistrate just got the law wrong. There's something called the presumption against extraterritoriality, by which courts are supposed to read statutes as applying purely domestically unless Congress explicitly says that the statute applies to conduct or evidence outside the United States. And it's interesting, the magistrate basically blew that doctrine off, didn't really even address it very much, and essentially said, well, the search here didn't really take place in Ireland where Microsoft servers were. It took place in the United States where the government opened the files and examined them, which I think is a pretty questionable premise of the decision. And as you mentioned, he also said, well, this isn't a real search warrant when it's issued under the Stored Communications Act. It's really more of a subpoena, since it's not allowing the government itself to do the searching, but it's allowing the government to compel the provider to disclose the evidence. And there are lots of cases in which subpoenas have been issued and upheld for evidence that's held by a U.S. company abroad. Both those, I think, premises of the court's, of the judge's ruling are highly questionable, so I think those will be the areas that Microsoft probably focuses on.
Yeah, I would have thought the Irish would have something to say about this. I know that the U.S. would not say, oh, sure, give the Chinese or the Russian government access to data stored in the United States because it's not really searched until they look at it in Russia or China.
Yeah, it would be interesting if other governments try to throw this back in our face and, as you say, do the exact same thing to us. I don't think the U.S. government would have quite the same view if we were on the receiving end.
And this is the first time that this has come up, as far as we know?
It's, you know, I don't know of any reported cases. I think in the past, in all likelihood, communications providers have just complied with warrants demanding information that the providers happen to store abroad. But now, after all of the Snowden revelations, there's been such an uproar about privacy, I think providers are bending over backwards to show that they care about privacy. And so in this instance, you know, Microsoft moved to quash or moved to vacate this search warrant.
Well, plus it's important from the point of view of if you want to sell people on your cloud services, you want to be able to say, oh, you want this in Germany under German law? Fine, we'll do it there. But if the U.S. government can say we don't care where it is, you still have to cough it up here, that puts U.S. industry at a pretty significant disadvantage.
Yeah, and I think that's another reason why they want to show their customers and potential customers that, hey, we're willing to go to the mat on this. And if we think the U.S. government is doing something untoward in trying to get your information, we'll fight it in court.
Yeah. Yeah, Brian, you probably remember this. There was a case in the 90s where they got a Russian hacker to come to the U.S. to Seattle. They busted him, they got his password, and they logged into his server in Russia to FBI agents. And the Russians then turned around and indicted the agents for carrying out an illegal search in Russia. So,
what was the outcome of that case? Did they drop the case against the
hacker? Think they went to Russia for the trial. I think we're still waiting. They didn't go to the Sochi Olympics either.
No, the guy that they logged into his stuff. What happened to him?
He went to jail.
Huh?
I can't remember.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. Huh? For a couple of years, right? It wasn't forever. Now that he's probably working for the National Security Agency. The other issue that came up in the courts was the question of when the police can search a phone when they arrest somebody. And the court heard endless argument, 2 hours of argument on that question in two different cases last term, practically the last cases argued in the year, which means the justices again are going to have to resolve a tough issue in very short order. They probably have less than a month to write the opinion. And I don't know, Michael, I looked at the coverage and quickly glanced at the transcript. It looked to me as though I could probably count three justices who said, yeah, the old rule is fine. Just, if he's got it on him, you can search it. And at least three justices who were not going there at all, who wanted to require a warrant to be obtained before you looked at the phone. And I could not tell where the traditional swing justices like Breyer or Kennedy were. Did you get a sense of where this case is coming out?
No, this is a really hard one to read. You know, it involves the search incident to an arrest doctrine, which basically says when the police arrest someone, the arrestee has a very limited expectation of privacy, and the police can search anything they find on his person for the purposes of protecting their own safety and also preventing him from destroying evidence. The California and the U.S. government both are seeking a bright line rule that basically says this same doctrine applies to digital evidence, you know, regardless of the fact that a cell phone can contain lots and lots of private information. The defendants are searching, you know, looking for a bright line rule that says the opposite, that says, look, the police can never search a cell phone absent exigent circumstances unless they go to a judge and get a warrant. They can seize the phone, but then they have to go get a warrant in order to search it. The court seemed very uncomfortable with either bright line rule, and so they're looking for a middle way, and it's very difficult to find one. You know, they tossed around the idea that, well, maybe you can allow a search without a warrant if it's an investigation of a serious offense, or maybe you can You know, depends on the type of phone. Is it an old flip phone, as it was involved in one case, or is it a modern phone with lots and lots of data? Is this a case where the evidence could easily be destroyed or not? Is there a way to get around that using a so-called Faraday bag?
So we actually joked about that, didn't we? We joked that this was going to be the first case that might turn on the existence of Faraday bags, but they actually talked about it.
It was a big part of the Solicitor General's or Assistant Solicitor General's argument in one of the cases in Riley. He said, look, it's not practical.
Let me ask you about that. I did see that, and there was a kind of embarrassing and funny moment when he said, yeah, the FBI built an entire Faraday room so that they could examine all of these things without having them getting any signals, but they built it in a building where Verizon had put an entire cell tower right on top of the building, so the signals were going right through. Was that on your watch? Is that that they did that?
No, not that I know of, but it's not quite as bad as New York City putting its emergency management facility right next to the World Trade Center after the first World Trade Center bombing. Sure. So
yeah,
I'll throw that one right back.
But, you know, it's interesting. This discussion comes up because I'm working on reporting out a story, and I'm not really sure how it's going to go, if I'm going to be able to get it, but it involved an organized crime gang operating out of Chicago, and these guys were, you know, directing a small army of guys that were running around cashing out accounts and things like this. And the story I heard was that essentially they arrested a bunch of these guys and grabbed their phones, but what they found was there was nothing on them. They had been remotely wiped.
Wow.
And I think, you know, I mean, this is all of this stuff, you know, security, insecurity, it's an arms race. And, you know, the natural response is going to be, you know, okay, fine. You want to seize our phones? We'll just make it so that we get better remote wiping.
You should release that story soon, because, in fact, some of the justices said when they asked Solicitor General's rep, are there any actual cases where phones were wiped?
Right.
And he said, oh, well, I can't point to one. They said, well, so why are you telling us that wiping is the most important thing? Which, you know, that's hypothetical. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe it won't. So he's going to be dying to submit your story to the Supreme
well,
Court.
Well, hopefully
of the United
I can
States.
Nail it down.
Yeah, it does make sense. And in fact, you could have any number of mechanisms that say, if you don't get a message every 24 hours, just wipe it.
Right, the dead man switch, right?
Yeah. Well, okay. So you don't have a prediction. You predict a middle ground and a confused one.
Yeah, I think that is my prediction, that there'll be a middle ground. I'm not sure they'll have a majority for whatever the ruling is. It'll be some mishmash of different opinions.
Well, you know, that I increasingly believe that's what you always get with these late April arguments. They don't have time to work out after they've seen each other's first drafts something that everybody can agree on. They just all say, well, I don't know if he's going to write what I want, so I'll write separately. And then once they've written separately, it looks so brilliant to them that they just want to publish it.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, so they're really spending the majority of their time right now trying to decide whether to grant my cert petition, which today was relisted for the fourth time. So they still haven't decided whether to grant or deny.
Yeah, he's
or summarily reverse, which is what I'm hoping for.
I don't think that's going to happen. I'm sure there are people who say he had it coming.
All right. Well, I'll take a bet on that.
Okay. Okay. You've heard it here. $5 whether there'll be summary reversal. I say no. Michael says yes. The White House released a report on big data that was, you know, a classic of its kind. It actually a pretty thoughtful, long report about big data and some interesting technological capacities stapled to a set of utterly humdrum and not particularly innovative sets of policy recommendations. And since 90% of the people who participated in the process were only interested in the policy recommendations, I'm not sure it's an enormous success. It does have, I mean, many of these recommendations are, there's only five of them, and they're pretty dull. The U.S. should lead the world in adopting policies for stimulating practical privacy policies, and we should encourage increased education and training on privacy protection. We ought to strengthen privacy-related technologies, and whatever regulation we adopt ought to be technology neutral. None, you could have written that without doing any of the work that is in the report. Probably the most interesting thing, and I'm not sure how interesting it is they say, look, if you're going to worry about privacy here, trying to stop collection and analysis is probably hopeless. You ought to focus on misuse of the data, the conclusions, rather than trying to say that collection is subject to some kind of predicate or analysis has to meet certain kinds of standards. And that is, I think, wise. It would argue, ironically, against requiring a warrant to get access to people's cell phones, because that's collection rather than actual use of the data. Whether there'll be any fruits from this, I think, is open to question. But this was John Podesta's maiden effort as a policymaker back in the White House again, and he got a good report. Nothing about national security in it, and no national security agencies participated in it. So it's all about civilian agency use of data.
There are a couple of interesting things, though. I agree with you in general. It's, you know, as with these typical panel reports, they don't really say much. But this one did support the idea of amending ECPA to require the government to get a search warrant for any sort of content, regardless of how old the communication is stored or whether it had been opened or not. That's something the Attorney General already announced his support for, so that's not terribly new. It's still, that would be a pretty big deal if the government did amend ECPA. And then there was also a recommendation that the U.S.
arguably inconsistent with the statement that policy attention should focus more on the actual use of big data and less on its collection and analysis. You can't ask for consistency from a political process.
And then the other thing that I thought you'd be up in arms about is that they said that we should extend privacy protections to non-U.S. persons, or at least establish policies that apply regardless of a person's nationality.
Yeah, I've already lost that fight with respect to national security information, so it's hard to believe there's something else that we should die in the ditch over. And the way that was written, both for national security information and I thought in the recommendations, it suggests that where appropriate, we ought to extend those benefits. And of course, you buried all of the decision making in the words "where appropriate."
Right, and it could be something as anodyne as extending Privacy Act protections.
Well, you can't give it all. You can't give them everything, because you can't give them the right to appeal or to sue. But you can certainly give them all the other stuff at some level. You have the right to ask to see your file, and if it's not classified and it's not sensitive, we can send it to you.
Yep.
Okay. The other thing that the White House did that I also thought was, you know, reasonably thoughtful was Mike Daniel, who's the cyber czar, put out a list of considerations he was going to use, and he went out of his way to say he was going to use, making it clear that's not NSA's decision or CIA's decision, in deciding when a zero-day exploit ought to be exploited for national security purposes and when it ought to be disclosed. It was all very much kind of common sense, right? He said, well, first we ask how important is this vulnerability, how much does it put at risk, how valuable would it be if we exploited it, how long could we exploit it, how likely is it we know if somebody else started using it so that we'd have to take it to the owners of the infrastructure. Nothing really surprising, and I don't think you can be more specific than he was about the kinds of considerations that enter into that sort of decision. But the transparency of saying, yes, we make these calls, the elaboration of the principles that are applied, I thought were probably good signs in terms of giving the public some idea of how these issues get aired inside the government. I don't know if, Brian, you've seen that. You must occasionally see exploits, but from your point of view, disclosing them is always the better choice because that's what you do, right?
Sure. I mean, at some level, this is you know, if you're going to use these things, you run the risk of disclosing them, right? And that's got to be what people who are nervous about this subject are most nervous about, which is, and I think you touched on it, which is, you know, how do you use these things without them having being turned around against you? And there's always that risk. But at least in the traditional financial space, I mean, it's really hard to use one of these vulnerabilities and not have somebody know about it right away. The benefit from, say, I want to use this term lightly, from, say, the U.S. government using a 0 days and an offensive capability is if they do so against a nation that is not, you know, as we would say, a traditional first world country, it's a lot easier to hide these things for quite some time. And especially if you're doing it against a country in which your security industry is prohibited from actually participating.
Right. usually you can find Kaspersky there.
Yeah, maybe. And, you know, I think it's telling with Stuxnet. It came up just because, what was it, a Belarusian antivirus firm discovered it. So there you have it.
To which it's probably appropriate to say, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think all of that is true. And it is getting, I suspect, a little harder to hide these things. I'm struck by the fact that what appears to be Russian government attacks are starting to get covered in the literature. Their tactics and techniques are showing up. For a long time, they were almost impossible for commercial security firms to identify, and now we're starting to see it. I don't know whether it's FireEye's ability to see stuff that is too clever to actually catch, but whose effects are a signature of abuse or what, but they're clearly getting, or maybe they just care less because they figure there's less.
They're starting to look for it more. Yeah, that's the thing. So when you have 100,000 new malicious software variants released on the internet every day, which is basically what we're dealing with now, most of these companies spend all of their time just trying to classify, to bag and tag these things. And only recently have the security industry sort of said, oh my gosh, you know, there's gold in them, our hills. We can actually mine this, and if we can show that, you know, people are using this for, you know, for government surveillance or whatever, I mean, that's what people are interested in. Let's focus on that.
Right.
And so now, you know, they sort of take a step back, and to quote from Eugene Kaspersky himself, he said, you know, you don't see the pixels for the picture, right? Now, the forest, he meant right. to say, you know, forest for the trees, but I thought it's a, you know, it's a nice thing. They see all these little threats, but until they take a step back and start looking at it in a more holistic view, it's real difficult for them to see the overall pattern.
Yeah, one of the things that I am proselytizing about is that people really need to focus their security by asking who wants my secrets and what are they going to do with them.
Right.
Because there are different tactics, there are different risks associated with it. You know, if people are after your credit card information, that's one thing. If they want to know what your negotiating strategy is in an M&A deal, that's another thing. And if they want to infect your software so they can bring down all your customers at once, that's a much bigger deal. And how much you spend on security probably should reflect what you're worried about and who you think has painted a target on you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of painting targets, CEO of Target is gone, and everyone seems to believe that it's the direct result of the hack of Target systems and how Target handled the hack. Michael, Brian, any observations on that? We were asking whether this was the first time a CEO had been fired because of bad security on their network, and the CEO of HB Gary was fired, but that was because Anonymous actually got really embarrassing emails out of his company, plus the fact that it was supposed to be a security company, but they hadn't secured their email.
Kind of a different subject, though, there. I mean, they're not interfacing with people the public who carries around credit cards.
Well, I worry a little that people are spending too much time worrying about credit card hacks and Social Security number hacks and not some of these more sophisticated strategic hacks. This is only going to make that worse because of the staggering consequences now, not just to the company, but to the CEO.
Yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
You're our guest, so you go first.
I was just going to say I think it probably has more to do with their response or lack thereof. I think it's telling that we are now in May, which is 6 months out almost from the breach coming to light, and they still don't have a chief information security officer.
Right.
How is that possible? But then I asked that question, and then I started looking at, who are the top 10 retailers in the United States? Well, let's look at their leadership page. Let's see who they have in security at the top of their of their executive. They might have chief information officer there.
But not a CISO.
Not a CISO. Not a chief information security officer. Not a chief security officer. Almost across the board.
That's interesting. You know, I went to a speech that Mike McConnell, a former head of NSA and a campaigner at Booz Allen for cybersecurity, gave. And he said, I'm just going to give you a couple of facts. Why don't I give them to you right now? Here's one. At Booz Allen, the CIO reports to the CISO.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was fascinating and probably right for them because they're clearly a target. But not to have a CISO is sad.
It's sad, and it speaks to the sort of the – and Michael can probably talk a lot about this. But, I mean, the way that – it's pretty much the same across the retail industry. You have an – and we've had this debate for over a decade now. It's like, is it physical security? Is it cyber security? You know, when you look at these cash registers, you know, who's in charge of that? Who owns that that problem? And in this case, you know, look, everything that's runs on technology is connected to the Internet. One way, shape, or another, and to try to pretend that is not the case is companies make that error in judgment at their own peril.
Yeah, it does seem to me the Internet of Things, all these sensors, industrial control systems, all of that does integrate the physical and the cyber world. Suzanne Spaulding, who runs the Department of Homeland Security's cybersecurity operations, preaches this endlessly, in part because she has responsibility for both physical security, guns and gates and guards, and for cybersecurity. And I used to make fun of her, but I think actually she's got a serious point there. We'll get her on and let her defend herself.
You know, it's true, even at the most rudimentary level, in so many of the HIPAA cases and the FTC settlements, including two very recent HIPAA settlements, the problem was not only the failure to encrypt medical information or personal information on a laptop, but then once again an employee storing that laptop in his car and then parking at the mall and having the car broken into. Or in another case, leaving the unencrypted information and the laptop unsecured, in the company's facility. So a combination of both failure to encrypt and poor physical security procedures.
Yeah, although I got to say that does feel like the kind of cities we'd have if we had no enforcement of the burglary laws and the death penalty for jaywalking. Encrypting those laptops is not really going to prevent any serious cyber attacks. It just happens to be the easiest thing that the enforcers can point to impose large fines.
Well, I think it's also interesting to look at. One of the responses Target has come out with is said, look, we're fixing this problem. We're going to spend $100 million implementing chip and PIN, even though they probably should have done it a decade ago. But essentially, they're saying, look, we're being proactive about this. And really, the truth is, they're facing a deadline in the middle, in October of next year. If they don't have these systems in place, they eat all of the fraud if there's card-present fraud. But the other thing to point out, I think, is important. Even if they had chip and PIN in place, it wouldn't have stopped this.
Right.
And the reason is it only makes the fraud less lucrative for the bad guys. They can still steal the card numbers.
And the PIN.
So here's the thing. And so what we've seen in every nation that has moved to chip and PIN is the fraud moves from card present. It doesn't go away. It's like you squeeze the balloon, the air goes somewhere else. It just goes online. So we're going to start to see a lot more card-not-present fraud as a result of more retailers moving to this chip and PIN technology. And the question is, are they ready for that? I would argue, they're not any more ready for that than they were for this one.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a chip and PIN skeptic in the terms of how valuable it is compared to the cost, which we'll all get to eat.
But just to follow up on Michael's point is the encryption part is very, very important because you're starting to see more retailers say, okay, well, is this it? Chip and PIN, really? That fixes the problem? Well, no, of course not. Unless you have point-to-point or end-to-end encryption within that environment, you're just setting yourself up to have this problem once again.
And then you have to encrypt the data at rest on your system, not just on some laptop in somebody's trunk. I'm a big believer in good encryption on the system. I just think the emphasis on encryption on laptops that then get stolen strikes me as basically saying, well, I see the guy jaywalking. Why not execute him? It's easier than going after burglars. They're hard to catch. All right. Well, let's get to the main part of our interview. There's one more piece of news that I just can't resist asking Brian about, which is we were all told that on the 8th of May there was going to be no more security support for Windows XP and we'd have to get off of Windows XP.
Right.
Many of us got off of it long ago, but there are a lot of applications that only run on XP. It appears now that Microsoft has blinked a little. Mm-hmm. They had a zero day that affected IE across the board, including on XP, and after they fixed everything else, they said, oh, yeah, and here's a fix for XP.
Right.
I don't know whether this is what to make of this. I mean, you can't count on them giving you fixes. The fixes that they give you are only going to be for certain kinds of exploits, so I just wonder whether we are now in a position where they're very rarely going to give us these things just because of public pressure or whether, and after all, they're doing this, right? They are actually developing all these fixes for paying customers who have said, I will pay extra if you'll keep me on a security contract. So aren't they in an odd position where they've now started to do some of this, and they're going to be withholding other fixes that they actually have?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to quite compute on the surface. I mean, if you're going to go cold turkey, right? Rip the Band-Aid off all at once. But I think I know probably a little bit about what Microsoft was thinking here, and we're probably going to see these one-off patches for zero-day vulnerabilities that affect XP for a little while. It's not like normal patches where the bad guys, they typically use those to figure out, kind of reverse engineer what Microsoft fixed,
right,
and then, takes them a little while to kind of work out where the vulnerability is exactly and how to develop an exploit for it. And that process takes a lot of time, and it doesn't happen with every patch cycle, as you probably know. So Microsoft, every second Tuesday of the month, Patch Tuesday, they call it, when they typically release the security updates. In this case, the very first vulnerability the company had to address after it stopped shipping updates was something that attackers were already exploiting.
Right.
And I guess, some faction within Microsoft decided it was too cruel to let the XP users swing in the wind without this update, so they decided to include it for XP users. And I think, the curious thing about this decision is that, the exploits that Microsoft said it had seen in the wild that were attacking this vulnerability, which, by the way, exists in every version version of Internet Explorer they ever produced, they said the exploits that they saw were only targeting IE 9 through 11.
Right.
Which none of those will even run on XP.
Right.
So go figure.
Yeah, that's weird. I don't know. I'm guessing if I'd been an in-house counsel, I would have said this is really dangerous because now we're going to get lawsuits from people who get exploited running XP, and they're going to say, "Yeah, I'd heard you were stopping support, but then you sent me updates, and you were. I just figured you were sending me updates if it was really serious that could really hurt me, and then I got had pwned." So there's some theoretical liability. Now, Microsoft hasn't been sued successfully for security flaws ever that I know of, so maybe they decided to take the risk. But this kind of stop-start policy is something that lawyers don't like to see their clients do. Well, you had a great story, I thought, about money mules in the United States that I wanted to talk about. And these weren't the classic money mules who answer ads saying, how would you like to deliver packages or handle our package delivery systems, where people can plausibly say and may even believe, well, they offered me a job. They say they'd pay me, 10% or 20% of the money I handled, and then I had some jobs to do with the money. It sounded reasonable to me, and I just, just did what they asked me as though I'd been employed. These are guys who are smart enough to actually, they know exactly what they're being asked to do, and so you can ask them to do things that are a little edgier.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how those gangs are organized and how they work here?
Sure, yeah. They call them, well, the folks here in the U.S., law enforcement a lot of times reference them as J-1 mules because a lot of them are here on work travel visas.
Right.
So they'll come, from Eastern Europe or from Russia, and they're here for the summer for a few months, and then they're allowed to travel for a couple weeks before they have to leave the country. And then it just so happens in a lot of cases when these folks have been involved in cyber fraud, they get tasked with some things when they're on vacation, essentially.
That way you pick up a little more spending money.
A little walking around money, a little traveling money, right? And that is kind of the sell.
And then you figure, well, I'm never going back to the United States if somebody catches me.
Right.
So
what
the hell?
Right. Yeah, they call them, in the underground, if you search for these services, they call them nerazvodny mules, which means not deceived. So they know.
Yeah,
they know what's going on. They know the score. The reason the bad guys like these mules as opposed to your traditional money mules that you just mentioned is they can generally be counted on not to screw up the little details, right? Because most of these regular money mules are, they're out of work. Look, let's face it, a lot of them are out of work for a reason. They're not the sharpest crayons in the box. So they tend to screw up, they get cold feet, or maybe they, transpose some numbers in the wire transfer or whatever. Anyway, Boris is unhappy about this, right? But this has been a major problem for years. It continues to be a problem. And if you go, so that story you referenced that I wrote looked at one particular J-1 mule service where, they basically advertised the existence and the readiness of these nerazvodny mules in every major city in the United States. So Miami, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, what have you. And, a lot of them, like I said, they're just about to, their visa's about to expire, so they pretty much deport themselves. And a lot of people have asked, can't the Department of Homeland Security do something about this? Well, frankly, it's the State Department's issue, and because they're the ones that issue these.
Visas. They issue them, but actually, this is a sore point. Only in this administration is it the State Department's issue. The law that created DHS almost moved the entire visa granting machinery to DHS because of some serious screw ups before 9/11 in Saudi Arabia, and they didn't do it. But instead, they said, "But DHS will make policy on visas."
Well, I'm sure that will save us if that happens.
Which means they should have the authority to say, certain kinds of people are not going to get these visas. We're going to start doing background checks on people.
Yeah. And I think that is what's needed here. I pressed the State Department on this for quite some time, and eventually they just gave me the hand and said, you know, we're not going to talk about this. And
call DHS.
Well, so here's the thing. In almost every one of these cases involving the J-1s, it's some mastermind in St. Petersburg or something who sets up a network of fake companies, and then they host these people to come over.
Oh, so they're not even getting summer jobs here.
Well, ostensibly they have a job, right? Somebody has set up this process and done all the paperwork, and, you know, is there a process on our side that goes and looks at these companies and says, how long have they been around? Did they just show up this year?
Well, there certainly could be. You know,
right.
the people who deal with a lot of these licenses, especially if they involve work, are USCIS. And, you know, obviously their first priority is make sure we aren't letting terrorists in. But I'm willing to bet that the companies that are set up like this have characteristics that pop out at you once you start doing some background, even without going out to visit them. There's got to be a lot that you can identify here that would lead you to say, I think this is a scam.
Yeah, and that may be happening. The last time I checked, the State Department was granting quite a bit fewer of these J-1 licenses to folks coming over. I don't know if they just, you know, are more reticent to do so, or if they're getting better at vetting these the sponsors and the folks coming over. But
depending on how fast you are at catching these guys, I mean, part of the reason to do this, you need mules, is you want to get the money out, and you want to get it out fast. So you know pretty quickly that the money's gone, and don't you know where it went? You know it went to this person at this Western Union office, and they have to show ID, I suspect, to get
it. Well, with the J-1s, it's actually a little different. So one of the things that the J-1s were asked to do is go around and create bank accounts for companies that had been set up.
Okay.
So they weren't the traditional thing where you know the mule pulls the money out and wires it overseas to a bunch of people via Western Union. They were basically doing wires out of these hacked companies to other companies that were set up, and then on from there to somewhere else. So just another step of obfuscation there.
Yeah. Although if it's the same company that they have this alleged J-1 job with, you could open that up. You say, okay, who's telling us they have a job with this company that just ran this scam?
Sure.
And let's make sure they don't leave.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, you know, normal regular mules, they're one and done, right? They burn them. With the J-1s, they typically get two or three or four transfers out of them before they leave the country. So there is a window there, but it's pretty short.
Yeah. But, you know, if you know who they are, their true identity, their passport information, within 24 hours, you can put a hold on their departure from the United States, and they're going to have a hell of a time getting out. Now, it's not impossible. Yeah. You know, maybe the coyotes in Mexico can have a two-way trade, but it's not easy. And it would certainly shut the traffic down if these students thought that this wasn't just a fun way to raise money, but it could lead to a jail term in the United States.
Right.
All right. Well, that's enough making policy for the government. You told me when I invited you on here that you were doing a story or looking at covert redirection. We joked here that Heartbleed was the first vulnerability that had a cool name and a logo, and like within 3 weeks now, covert redirection has a cool name and a logo. And frankly, both of them, the second day story was a whole lot less worried than the first day story, to the point where a lot of people are saying this covert redirection thing is a known vulnerability that is just being given a cool logo and title. You didn't write the story, so I assume you may have come to the same conclusion. Huh?
Yeah, I'm sort of still sussing out what the importance here is. I mean, just for the listeners who don't know, aren't familiar with this, basically it's an alleged vulnerability in open authentication protocols like OAuth and OpenID.
And these are a big deal, right? This is every time somebody says, would you like to log in with Google or Facebook or Twitter, and you say yes and you enter your credentials, it's the this is a possible compromise of those credentials.
Right. Well, that was sort of the idea behind this, which was if you don't want to remember 500 passwords, you can just use your Facebook or your Twitter account password, and these protocols allow you to log in without actually sharing those credentials with the site that you're logging into. So it's enough for them to say Facebook thinks you are who you say you are, so we trust that.
The theory is that when they give you those login opportunities, you're actually logging into Facebook.
Correct.
Right? And it's a direct line to Facebook, and the site doesn't get to see them.
Right.
And the covert redirection basically undermines that assumption pretty substantially.
Yeah, well, I mean, it involves the use of open redirects on third-party sites.
If you go to a site that's kind of cheap, not mainstream site where they would have somebody who actually cared about security, it would be easy to say, hey, look, they left their redirection open, redirect it.
Right. It's less common than, a lot less common than it used to be, but you would be surprised, with companies, it's like we went back in time and then we forgot some of the lessons that we learned. Lots of companies have tons of third party content on their site that pulls places from 30 to 50 different locations on the web.
Rather than just figure out, well, where do you want this content to go, they're saying, why don't we just open the redirects, and that way I don't have to go in and add to the list every time we get a new person.
Well, there's some of that, but the point is that there are more than enough places on the web where these open redirects are available, and the idea behind this vulnerability is, well, if you can somehow leverage one of those when somebody goes to log in at, say, Google or Facebook, they're going to see the Google and Facebook domain, and for all intents and purposes, they are there, but when they go to log in, you may actually be able to send them somewhere else that they didn't want to go. My read on this is not exactly a it is not a new problem,
right?
And it's one that's been with us. It might leverage an old problem in a slightly new way, but you're right. You mentioned a lot of the companies have been asked about this, and they're kind of like, well, we can't fix the internet. We can't fix what third-party sites
do. Google or Facebook would say, we offer this service to people.
Exactly.
If they have open redirects, what are we going to do about it? Well, I guess one of my questions is, surely whether there's redirect available from a particular site is something you could measure by pulsing the site, isn't it?
So one answer is, whitelist. So right. if the site provider says, okay, we're only going to let certain URLs that we trust interact with this. And this, by the way, extends not only to the Googles and the Facebooks and everybody, but all the third party sort of, like, think of the apps that you use on your phones. What kind of whitelisting process, if any, do they have? And how can they be abused? So, I mean, my advice to folks is no different than what I've been saying for years, which is, it's nice when you get an email from Facebook or Twitter that says somebody liked your post, somebody wants to connect with you. Well, it's probably safest not to respond to those emails, because that's the most likely vector for something like this to be exploited. So if you want to interact with these networks...
Oh, thank you. You've given me a reason not to respond to that.
Well, just go online. Open up a browser and, click that bookmark that you trust instead of clicking on links willy-nilly in email. And this is something, we've been hammering home for years, but they keep making it easier to ignore the best advice. So
yeah.
There you have it.
Yeah, yeah. This is sort of the old story that the people who care about security least, because they have the least skin in the game, are the people who are going to be subject to the compromise.
The ones that are going to get fished in.
Yeah,
exactly.
Even if you care about security, if you go to a site that doesn't, you're going to get waterhole attacked, you're going to get redirect attacked. There's just a whole bunch of things that can happen. And it's the weakest link, the dumbest site on your bookmark list.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. All right. Well, what I wanted to talk about, this is what the part I was hoping we'd get a chance to talk about, is how you break your stories. A lot of your stuff, it looks to me, comes from being on the inside. You pronounced the Russian name for whitting mules with an impressive sounding familiarity with Russian. Do you speak Russian? Do you read Russian?
I've been learning it for about 6 or 7 years now, so I learned it mainly just to get by on the forums.
Right.
I haven't had a lot of opportunity to speak it. So, yeah.
And so, do you spend a lot of time then just pretending to be somebody else on these forums?
I don't pretend or not pretend. I mean, I just kind of lurk for the most part.
Right.
I don't identify myself as a reporter in most cases, unless it's a one-on-one interaction via instant message. I'll do that. I don't have a problem with that. but, you know, I'm just there to gather information and to observe for the most part.
But they can't like having you there. Occasionally, they must hate having you there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for the most part, they do not like it. Although the guy in charge of the site that's been selling principally all the 40 million credit cards stolen from Target actually changed his homepage on his shop with a picture of me, and it was some fake passport that somebody put up with my picture on it, and, you know, linked to all my personal information and said, we just want to say thanks to Brian Krebs for advertising our shop and making it the most successful shop in the underground, and to support, you know, to show your thanks, you know, send him something as well. And, you know, they list my home address.
Oh,
and
yes,
all this
I'm
stuff,
sure.
So.
But
yeah, they really don't like it, and they've shown their displeasure in all kinds of really interesting ways.
Yeah, I remember they've spoofed 911 calls.
There was a bit of misreporting on that, and that's my fault. I take responsibility for that. Although I must say it came from a policeman on the scene, so he didn't have all the facts. But essentially, they sent the equivalent of a SWAT team to my house and basically spoofed an emergency call about a hostage situation at my house. And this after I had warned my local police department that this actually might happen. And to their credit, they actually did call me.
To ask if this was an
emergency. If it was real,
they
I was vacuuming downstairs. We were having company over that night and I didn't hear the phone ring. How that was perpetrated was kind of interesting. And who it was perpetrated by was actually a 16-year-old kid in California. And he used a service, TTY service for the deaf.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And, you know, basically logged into his AOL, instant message account and started chatting with one of these operators and said, yeah, I'm Brian Krebs. I'm hiding in my closet. The Russians are after me.
Oh.
You know, send the SWAT team. And so that's
interesting. And so on the TTY, there's less location capability than on regular 911.
Well, if you're just logging in through the interwebs to access these things, what kind of trace is there?
Just tore it around.
Yeah, tore in. And those services, even if they know, even if the people in those operating those relay services know there's fraud, they're not allowed by law to say anything or to not relay the call. They have to relay whatever the caller.
Even, and they're not allowed to add comment?
Nope.
That's crazy.
Yeah. A lot of people think so.
All right. I'm sure that there was a reason for that back in the day when they first put these in.
Talk to the FCC about it.
Well, yeah. I'm sure the part of it was we should give people using TTY the same privacy that everybody else has.
Sure.
And just because you have to go through somebody doesn't mean that person should be able to spend time evaluating what you're saying and communicating on your channel. The law clearly needs to change, and actually maybe just the interpretation of the law needs to change.
Well, specifically, if you get a 911 call from the TTY service and they're talking about a hostage situation,
right.
I mean, take that with a big grain of salt.
Yeah. No, that's right. These 911 spoofs are very serious. Somebody's going to get hurt.
Yeah, I don't think that they move the ball on this problem, which is going on in across police departments across the nation every week. Most part, it's young men, upset about losing some game online,
right.
And they decide to have some laughs. I mean, this is like the modern prank call, right? Except every time they do it, they put people's lives at risk, and it costs about $10,000 every time they send one of these police units to respond. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they just mean it, make it attempted murder, and then we'll see what happens after that. But the truth is, the federal system doesn't know what to do with minors, do they, Michael?
Michael is muted.
I'm just kidding.
I've got me on mute because all the sirens that go by here.
Okay.
Yeah, so we were wondering whether there was any hope of going after people who do this, the kids who do this and think it's cute, in ways that would seriously deter future episodes like this, like send them away on a beef of attempted murder.
Yeah, I don't know if you could make that stick, but you know the media treatment of it seems limited to all these cases that happen in Hollywood to celebrities, and so they all have sort of a joking tone about it without really recognizing the seriousness or potential seriousness of it.
Yeah, I think anytime the police officer unholsters his weapon, it's dangerous for everybody around him. If he thinks he's in a situation where he might be at risk, boy, he's got leave to start shooting.
Yeah, well, that was actually the subject of a summary reversal in the Supreme Court today, where a police officer shot a kid, pierced his lung and his liver. The kid lived, fortunately, because the officer had mistyped by one digit a license plate of a car that he thought was driving suspiciously, and that their car was reported to have been stolen. Turns out that the car that he followed was actually, you know, not stolen, and the kid was in front of his own house, but he got up on his knees and the cop shot him because he, you know, cop says he feared for his safety. The kid says, "I was on my knees, not doing anything."
Yeah.
Well,
You're right about that.
There was a guy that I testified about who, in Florida, who was the victim of identity theft, and somebody in Florida stole his ID and then started a crime rampage in Miami that ended with using an AK-47 and killing two or three cops. And this guy who had been telling the Florida DMV, somebody's using my name and they have a driver's license in my name. Here's my name, here's my picture, here's my other ID. You got to do something about that. They took that correspondence and used the picture he'd sent them to say, all points alert, here's a cop killer, this is his picture, stop him. And he actually wasn't stopped because it was run on TV, and one of his relatives called him up and said, "Get inside now." And call. And he actually had to call and straighten it out, and they still didn't believe him. But he was, you know, inches from being shot, because I'm sure he would have been resisting arrest if somebody had come across him while he was driving.
Well, it's a good example of how sort of, you know, understanding of today's technologies and the threats lags both at the consumer level but at the law enforcement level. It's unfortunate that so many counties and cities in this country got, you know, gobs of money from DHS after 9/11 mm-hmm. to go build these attack units, and they're itching to go, you know, kick in somebody's door. And, I mean, man, every one of those units needs to be sat down and go through a class about this, because it's real and it's happening all over the place.
Yeah, I talked to a sheriff who got one of those mine resistant vehicles, I said, "Do you really need this? What happens? When do you use this?" He said, "Well, you know, if somebody's locked himself inside his house, we just drive up in this thing and they come out." So I one of the things I don't understand, I feel like I have some sense of how the Chinese do what they do and why they're doing what they're doing. I have nowhere near the same sense about what's happening in Eastern Europe and Russia, who these guys are, where they mainly are, how close they are to the government. What's your sense about that, and do you think you would necessarily see it in the fora that you're hanging out in?
Oh, sure. One of the things I've come to the conclusion about, just from years of lurking on these forums, is it's, you know, it's a lot smaller community than you might think.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like, well, for instance, you will see, across each of these forums is very stratified. So they'll have a sub-forum for just about every type of crime that you can imagine. And when you start looking at enough of these, you see the same guys moderating the sub-forums across these various communities. And there's a reason for that, because most of these guys have been around and in the industry for 15 years now. And so they're networking, they know everybody. They've seen it all.
Right.
And they can hook people up who are looking for legitimately, quote unquote, legitimately right. looking for criminal resources. They can make those matches very quickly. The other thing that's really interesting.
And they get paid on a kind of commission basis?
No. So those guys, typically are also the biggest, sellers of criminal services. So they will have their services stickied at the top of each sub-forum.
The European Union is going to get on their case. You know, they can't be misusing their position as a search destination in that way.
Well, this is the interesting thing about the way these forums work is there's always a tension between keeping it exclusive and letting new guys on. Because the new guys are the ones who really don't have a clue. And if they don't have a clue, they're happy to pay to help somebody get them a clue. And that might mean you don't know how to set up a botnet. Okay, look, there's a guy that's going to help you set this up soup to nuts.
Right.
And you'll make maybe 20% of what you would have made if you could do it all by yourself. But once you figure out how it's done, you sort of can reverse engineer the process and get smarter next time. But those guys who don't know anything, they're ankle biters and they're annoying for the experienced guys, but they're also the ones that bring them the most business. So there's this constant tension in the communities about this. And the other thing I would say about the way business gets done in the sort of traditional cybercrime space is it's a bit like Ocean's 11 a lot of times. You hear a lot of discussion of organized cybercrime. It's more like disorganized cybercrime because you have a lot of these guys have never met each other.
Right.
Like a little Ocean's 11, right? You know, this guy's good at, developing custom exploits. This guy's good at bulletproof hosting. You get a bunch of these guys to work together, and pretty soon you have a pretty decent operation. There was a really interesting case a couple of years ago. It was a major banking Trojan, and they actually arrested these guys in Russia and Ukraine. And the reason they arrested them is pretty interesting, and it speaks to the other point I want to make, which is as long as they're not targeting their own people, they're pretty much safe from prosecution as long as they stay in those areas.
I've never forgotten a piece of malware that infected all these machines and then checked to see what
Russian and Ukrainian keyboard, whether they had
their Ukrainian keyboard.
Yeah.
And if it did, it said, okay, uninstall.
Right. And there's still some of that going on. I think the golden rule, thou shalt not target your own people, has kind of gone out the window, which is might explain some of the prosecutions you've seen in these countries. But for the most part, that doesn't when these guys do get busted, in the case of this group that was developing this banking Trojan, they almost exclusively picked on banks in their own country, which was a big no-no.
Wow, that's weird.
And they stole something like $250 million from Russian and Ukrainian banks. And so they arrested these guys, and it was a group, I think, of about two dozen programmers, and they found them. They were scattered all across like six different time zones in Russia and former Soviet states, and a lot of these guys had never met. They'd never met each other. They only knew each other online, and they some of them had been hired to write very specific components of the code.
They didn't even know what the target was.
Some of them didn't even know what they were doing. You know, it was like, hey, we need something to that gets past the firewall. We need something that evades this detection. And frankly, you see a lot of that in the underground, and it's not hard to find. You go on these job forums, and you'll see, hey, we need somebody who's good at PHP that can get this project done in 2 weeks, and we're going to pay this much. And they don't tell them what the master plan is.
Why should they? Yeah.
Right. And so I've tracked some of these guys down, and they're like, yeah, I wrote that. Big deal. What's the big deal? It's just code. It's ones and zeros. It's not evil. It's not good. It's just software.
Interesting. So NSA could just outsource a lot of their work. They could probably get it done cheaper.
They probably could. I don't think there's any question about that.
Huh. And your sense of whether the government plugs into this ecosystem?
Are you talking about the
Russian government?
The Russian government. It's a difficult question to answer with any certainty. We do know from anecdotal incidents that there are a number of cases in which the government there more or less looks the other way, so long as, again, they're not targeting their own folks. And I think, you know, it's tough to say how much of that activity is tolerated because the government there has other things to worry about, and or because, you know, many of these attackers can actually be pretty useful in situations that serve the government's agenda or objectives. For example, if there's a dissident group in Russia that the Kremlin doesn't like, they may be trying to organize online. It's not uncommon to see groups that pop up all of a sudden and do things to try to flood the message. There was back when the street demonstrations were going, and Navalny there was in Russia, and there, you know, it seemed like Putin was kind of in some shaky ground there. They were organizing these marches and these gatherings, these demonstrations via Twitter.
Right.
And they were doing it using, you know, hey, we're going to meet here, and they'd use hashtags.
Right.
So very soon after that, we saw these botnets that leveraged tens, you know, thousands of
using the hashtag to try to,
right,
to try to dilute the message.
Dilute the message, yeah, to the point where you couldn't, you could just sit there, you'd load the hashtag and you couldn't actually see the message you wanted to see because it was just cruising by so quickly in the Twitter stream. And so, you know, also, if you have the cash, it's possible to essentially purchase protection from prosecution, or to purchase prosecution against your enemies if you
right.
want. And this is in fact a major theme of a book that I have coming out in November, so if you don't mind my plug here.
Please do.
It's called Spam Nation. And it's about two of the biggest cybercrime kingpins in Russia who were collectively responsible, I think, for paying the salaries of the world's top virus writers, bot masters, and spammers. And these two guys were running competing organizations that paid spammers to promote the, you know, the male enhancement drugs, you know, all the Viagra right. spam that you get in your inbox. And they basically decided, you know, hey, the world's too small, for the big of us, for both of us to operate. So they had hackers break into each other's operations and steal and leak to me and to law enforcement years worth of emails,
I
text
remember
documents.
When you published some of that.
Yeah. Called it the Pharma Wars.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really detailed the, you know, the front companies and all these networks these guys had set up to sort of make these operations run very smoothly. And the one interesting section of the book that's sort of is about what we're talking about here, both of these kingpins funneled millions of dollars to Russian politicians via sporting leagues in Russia. And this is an interesting thing that I really wasn't aware of until I started doing the research on this, but most people in the Western world tend to think of sports as a money-making
right.
enterprise. In Russia, they're money-losing enterprises, except for the people who run them, and they all happen to be top politicians in Russia. So this is a way to get money to these folks in a quasi-legitimate
yes.
way.
Okay.
And so that's what these guys did. They both funneled, I don't know what the total was, like a couple million dollars to the guy who was running the basketball league and another guy running the volleyball league. And both of those guys were ex-KGB, ex-FSB guys who were now, you know, three or four rungs down from Putin, you know.
Right.
So it was really interesting to see that dynamic.
That's fascinating. Yes. Yeah, so those guys, of course, I'm sure that the favors run both ways, right?
Right.
The money may go to FSB guys, and the FSB guys say, instead of money, you know, why don't you do us a favor?
Right.
Take out something in Georgia or East Ukraine.
Or in a less organized, you know, more local fashion, you know, they get a knock at the door, and it's like, hey, you know, we know what you've been doing here, and, you know, what you're doing is punishable by, you know, 5 years in prison or a $5,000 fine. So,
right, which you can pay
yeah,
right here. Right,
now. Exactly.
Well, Spam Wars by Brian Krebs?
Spam Nation.
Spam Nation
yeah.
by Brian Krebs, coming out when?
November 18th.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, and can you reserve it now on Amazon?
If you can't write the second, you will be able to soon.
Okay, yeah. That's great. Well, we're probably coming to the end of our program, where we traditionally ask if people are giving any speeches or producing anything that they want to talk about. I'll start with Michael Vadas. Michael, any speeches coming up or other publications?
Nothing coming up in the near future.
All right. And Brian, besides Spam Nation?
Oh, gosh. I'm giving a talk at Checkpoints, having a thing here in what is the big convention center there over in Maryland, right on the water.
Oh, yeah, right.
That's later this week, and then I've got like three or four public speaking security keynotes the rest of the month.
So, excellent. Yeah, wow. A lot, so. Yeah, that's so you would do a lot of speaking, huh?
Probably more than I'd like, just because it takes so much time.
It does, yeah.
You know, and I have trouble working when I'm on the road, but
yeah,
it's
I have
fun.
The same
it's,
thing.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity to meet lots of people. So,
well, that's very good. And I have three things to talk about next week. The Oslo Freedom Forum. They promised me that they will not be using me as a pinata. That'll be in Oslo on Tuesday the 13th, and then. This is an ugly travel schedule. On Thursday the 15th, I'll be in Mountain View, California, talking to the 2014 Legal Frontiers in Digital Media panel. And then on Friday the 16th, I'll be at the Information Security Association's Information Security Summit in Los Angeles. I will be a complete wreck by the end of the week. But if you're in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Oslo, let me know and we'll get
together. Is that ISSA you're speaking of?
Yes, ISSA.
Well, say hi to Stan Stahl for me.
I will. That's he's going to be the moderator. Nate Cardozo from ACLU, Alex Joel from DNI. He was a former guest on our podcast. Monica Ryan from the FBI Civil Liberties Unit and Alex Abdo from the ACLU National Security Project. It'll be an active panel for sure, and don't expect a lot of consensus. So thank you very much, Brian. This was a lot of fun. We'll do it again. Hope you'll come back.
Yeah,
that'd be great. Michael, thank you so much for doing this. Jason will be sorry he missed this one. This has been episode 18 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas and Brian Krebs, and we hope you'll join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.